31-36. Mr. Crutland, you got a brief update, and do we have a Senate seat?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This measure expands workers' choice in who can attend them if they're an injured worker.
And is there a Senate seat?
I think we're first in.
Always first and only, but. Go ahead, state your names for the record and.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm Jennifer Weber, representing the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys. And with me is Chris Moore, an attorney who practices out of Eugene. I have some written testimony. I'd like to briefly summarize the bill for you and give you an example of how we think that it would positively impact patient choice for injured workers. I would like to say, first of all, that the Management Labor Advisory Committee, we have presented this bill to them, but they have not taken formal action on it. What this bill does is allows injured workers to be treated by a physician who is not on the panel of the managed care organization that they're in, but who agrees to comply with all the rules, terms, and conditions of that MCO regarding the services that they are to provide. So, again, just to expand the choice, the reason for this, and I'll give you one example, there's an MCO called Complete Quality Care in Portland, and workers who work for United Parcel Service in Portland are put into that MCO when they're injured on the job. According to its May 1998 provider list, CQC had 12 chiropractors on its panel. Five of them were in Portland. Then in the September 1998 provider list, they had only 9 chiropractors, and only 3 of those were in Portland. And on its most recent list, out this February, it was down to 7 chiropractors on its list. So as you can see, on these MCO panels, the number of providers diminishes, and so the workers have less and less choice of physicians who they can see, but and that also makes it more difficult for them to get an appointment, to be able to get in, to get timely care. So what we're advocating is simply the ability to expand the physicians and other medical providers where injured workers can go for care. And with that, I'll turn it over to Chris Moore for comments.
Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Moore. I'm an attorney from Eugene. I represent primarily injured workers in workers' compensation cases in Oregon's workers' comp system. First point that I wanted to make about the bill is that the requirement on the doctor is that the doctor has to comply with the managed care contract, which means that they're going to have to comply with the fee structure that's in place. They're going to have to follow the dispute resolution system that's in place with the managed care organization. But there's a problem that we're seeing, and certainly we see it in Lane County. We have right now 7 neurosurgeons in Lane County. The 2 managed care organizations that are used by the 2 major insurers in our county, Liberty Northwest Safe Corporation, have systematically excluded the vast majority. We're now down to 3, and the only reason we have 3 is that there's a relatively new neurosurgeon in town who was placed on managed care list. What we're seeing is that the doctors are excluded not for providing inappropriate care, that is to say care that the Department of Consumer and Business Services has found inappropriate, but rather because they're treating patients or they're advocating for patients. For instance, if the managed care organization determines that care is not appropriate, the doctor takes a dispute to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, care is found appropriate, and the doctors are being told that that's an inappropriate behavior and is not to be tolerated by the managed care organization. We're also noticing that in situations where people with a long-standing claim, an accepted condition, they need surgery, they are not a managed care organization, They are treating with a physician. The physician recommends surgery, and within days of that recommendation for surgery, they're enrolled in a managed care organization that that doctor's not a member of, simply to exclude surgery or exclude the possibility of requesting surgery. More and more panels are being made up of the doctors who do the evaluations for insurance companies as a significant portion of their practice rather than treating people. And what we're seeing is a reduction in the options of reasonable care for these injured people. The point that I started with, though, is the one that I want to finish with as well. It's not as if we're asking that managed care organizations be required to treat people or be required to allow treatment that isn't appropriate or that they somehow are stuck providing care that they otherwise wouldn't have to provide. What we're asking is that they insurers not be allowed to use managed care organization as a way of depriving treatment that's otherwise appropriate and otherwise reasonable and necessary, and to manage people in such a way that they don't get care that they need and that is appropriate. The doctor, whatever else is going to happen, the managed care organization gets to manage that doctor. If the doctor doesn't comply with the rules, they're not going to get care. And having said that, I thank you for your consideration and appreciate the opportunity to come speak to you today.
Is there a vice chair in the house?
Dan? Here too.
Any questions?
Yes.
The committee?
Yes.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair.
I
walked in the door and you were talking about chiropractors now.
Yeah.
Are you doing anything different with the chiropractic profession than has not been done in the past? Or is this, what?
No.
Why
there,
are we talking?
Our bill doesn't change anybody who is currently can treat an injured worker as part of an MCO. There's no different standards for physicians. My example that I gave regarding chiropractors was simply to illustrate that on an MCO panel, the number of providers for these workers in particular on this MCO is diminishing,
mm-hmm.
and so the patient choice is diminishing. On that same list, for orthopedic
mm-hmm.
doctors,
okay.
There were 38 providers, and now there's only 15.
May I follow up? Because what I'm trying to get at is what, mm-hmm. tell me, I understand when this workers' comp bill was redone, chiropractors' role was diminished, but
mm-hmm.
could you explain what the role of the chiropractor is right now? Do they have to be referred to by the primary care physician? Is that the way it works?
Yeah, I'll refer that question to Chris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette, in a non-managed care situation, in order to treat with chiropractor, after the first 30 days of the claim or the first 12 visits, the injured worker is going to have to be referred by an MD or a DO mm-hmm. to the chiropractor. In a managed care situation, that's going to be governed by contract within the MCO. In other words, the MCO could decide that they're willing to make a chiropractor an attending physician on their own, and by statute, they're required to include a chiropractor on the panel.
Good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David. Morning, Chris.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Chris Davey with SAFE Corporation, here today to speak in opposition to House Bill 3136. This bill attempts to make changes to the structure of managed care, which has pretty much continued without major change since 1990. It was a key part of the reforms that were passed in the 1990 special session. That structure was continued in 1995 under Senate Bill 369, and many of the sunsets that were included in Senate Bill 369 related to managed care. So during the last interim, the Management Labor Advisory Committee took a close look at managed care, primarily at the sunset items, but they also took testimony on how managed care had been operating in the state. They, of course, reached unanimous agreement on changes that were included in Senate Bill 460 that has passed both chambers and has been since signed by the governor. And so House Bill 3136 is taking a completely different tack with managed care and making a fundamental change in the way that managed care operates. And we don't think that passage of 3136 would be appropriate without the approval of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. Although they've been, I think, alerted to the existence of this bill, I'm not aware that they've given it any serious consideration yet. As far as the specifics of the bill goes, physicians right now join managed care organizations and they agree to the terms of the managed care organization because that organization can, amongst other things, deliver a steady stream of patients to those providers. This bill would allow any provider who qualifies as an attending physician to get that supply of patients without the requirement of joining the managed care organization. And if that's the case, then ultimately there would be less incentive for physicians to belong to managed care organizations, and the good results that we've seen from them would be over time diminished. The bill would not allow a managed care organization to bar a physician for any prior violation of their rules. All this bill says is that when a new patient comes along, they would have to agree to the terms and conditions of the MCO. They can give lip service to those terms and conditions. They could then violate them. They could then, presumably under the MCO rules, be disqualified from treating that patient, but there would be nothing to stop them going through that same routine time and time again with the next patient that comes through the door. Existing law also already allows an opt-out from the managed care organization, and again, this was part of the statute that was crafted in 1990. If a worker has an established relationship with a family doctor who is, an MD, who is a general practitioner, family practitioner, or an internist, then that doctor can agree to the terms of the MCO and can continue to treat the worker. Prior testimony said that there are some problems with the supply of physicians who want to be members of parts of the MCO. That issue is already addressed by the existing statute, and under 656-260, it requires that a managed care organization include an adequate number of each category of medical service providers to give workers adequate flexibility to choose providers from among those individuals who provide services under the plan. That is regulated today by Workers' Comp Division. They have extensive rules on managed care organizations. And if an MCO is not living up to the intent of that statute, that's within the regulatory power of the Workers' Comp Division to deal with that. So for those reasons, we're opposed to this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
This is a kind of a personal thing with me because I've talked with you about my constituent who I think was caught in a dilemma here. His physician, who was an orthopedic surgeon, I believe, discontinued belonging to that, and he was denied services of an additional doctor in the Eugene area, I believe, and I may have to verify that with Mr. Moore, but I think this bill would help address the situation of that kind of a shortage. And could you respond?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Morris. I don't remember all the facts of the case. I remember the conversation that we previously had about that. And I believe that worker had been treated by a physician who was a member of the MCO and then withdrew from the MCO. And under this bill, if that physician, although not a member of the MCO, agreed for that patient to subscribe to the terms and conditions, then that doctor would be able to continue to treat that worker. I think that's correct.
Okay.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This bill is somewhat similar to one we heard last week dealing with nurse practitioners. Because of the information we received from the governor's office very early in the session that the bill has not come through MLAC, but not looked up favorably by the governor's office, I would ask the sponsors of the bill if they want to pursue the idea to go back to MLAC and get MLAC's blessing on the bill. Of course, because of our deadline, this bill will be past that deadline to move, but we do have other workman comp Senate bills coming over from the Senate that we, if in fact it's somewhat something that MLAC feels is important and should be put in, we could always do that. Thank you very much for bringing the issue forward. So before I quit, is there anyone else who did not get a chance to testify, sign up, would like to testify? Be known, close the public hearing. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 3059. Open a public hearing. Mr. Putman.
Mr. Chairman, I believe the committee wants to finish the testimony of people who signed up, and we weren't able to get to it the last meeting. This requires DEQ to do an annual survey on recycling of beverage containers.
Okay, last time we had three people we did not, actually we had two people we never got to at all and one we had to cut off in the middle. So we'll start today with Jay Crockett and Bob Danko. Are you in the room?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Would you like to proceed with me?
Yes, Ms. Ray.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Judy Crockett, and I'm
sorry. I thought it was Jay.
That's all right. My handwriting is hard to write at the best, hard to read at the best of times. So. I'm the legislative chairperson for the Association of Oregon Recyclers, and I'm here today in strong support of House Bill 3059. The Association of Oregon Recyclers is a not-for-profit coalition of individuals, governments, businesses, and other not-for-profit organizations, all committed to encouraging recycling and waste reduction. Our members are involved in all aspects of recycling, from collection to processing to manufacturing, and to planning city and county programs. Due to the way the Oregon bottle bill is structured, every time a bottle bill container ends up in the trash or in a curbside recycling bin, the distributor who sold the container is allowed to keep the nickel that otherwise would have been refunded. The Department of Environmental Quality, and you'll hear from them next, has estimated by doing very thorough counts of what we throw away in our trash that there are about 150 million bottle bill containers every year that end up in our trash. And that would amount to roughly $6.5 million worth of deposits. One of the reasons why we are supportive of this legislation is that we want to find out exactly how much of a problem this is. And those of us who represent governments who are trying to increase recycling want to figure out what they can do to keep those containers out of the trash. But unless we have accurate information, we really have difficulty in planning those programs. Another reason why we're here is that last year the same measure came before the committee, not this committee, but the previous one, and the distributors came forward and said that they would gladly, voluntarily provide this information. They said that they would have... My recollection is that they said they would have no problem in providing this, but not to force them to provide it, to let them do it voluntarily. And so the committee chose at that time, fine, if they want to provide it voluntarily, why put it in the law? Subsequently, it turned out that they were not willing to provide complete and accurate information voluntarily, and so now we're coming back to you to say, they said they were going to do it, they didn't do it, let's get this information. In many states, this deposit, not in many, in some states, this deposit amount, this $6.5 million, or whatever it may be, I agree with the distributors, for example, that some people, but not a lot, are coming across from other states and bringing containers. But it's hard to believe that a substantial number of people make it their business to haul a bunch of empty bottles and cans over the state line just to redeem them in Oregon. I believe, though, that there is some over-redemption in some localities, but for the most of the state, I doubt that this is the case. It would be great to get accurate information. It would be easy for them to provide it. The survey would not be burdensome, and it might allow us to consider whether we want to take that $6.5 million, which was, or whatever it turns out to be, which most people think is helping recycling, and put it into recycling programs or into the state budget to use for environmental or other purposes. I think that it's a simple bill, it's an easy bill to comply with, and I urge you to go ahead and pass it.
Thank you very much. Questions? Go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. Apologize in advance, I've been ill and my voice may not hold too long. I have written testimony which I passed out, but I'll just respond to some of the questions that I heard last time when this bill was before you, the one we didn't get to speak. Just to walk down a couple things, there was a concern about the fiscal impact that this bill may have on the department, and we turned in a fiscal impact that the fiscal impact would be minimal, and it would indeed be minimal. This is a voluntary survey. We did the voluntary survey this past biennium at very little cost to us. Continuing to do it would have very little cost. We already survey 700 to 800 businesses annually for recycling information. This would be a very small add-on to what we already do. We get detailed information on recycling. This would be very basic information. Basically, two numbers we're talking about from about 80 or 90 distributors. So, it's a very small incremental increase in the amount of work we do in determining recycling rates anyways. We did the voluntary survey. The fiscal impact really is minimal. I mentioned this voluntary survey because we did it hoping we would learn some good information. We didn't end up learning really anything. maybe the word voluntary is what made the response be so limited, but I believe of the 70 or 80 voluntary surveys we sent out, we only got 15 back, and really none of those 15 had what I'd call good information, be able to tell what's going out and what's going in deposits. There was a question, I believe, on confidentiality. I think there was, and we've been very successful. State law is very clear on confidentiality, and when the law says something shall be kept confidential, we've had no problem in keeping that confidential. Interestingly, on the voluntary survey, we allowed the voluntary respondents to check, you know, if they would like to keep their information confidential. And we've heard testimony about container recovery in Portland area that could consolidate the data for the Portland area. And I was going to share their report that they submitted to us with you so you could see the information that Crank Container Recovery provided us in this voluntary survey. They checked the box confidential, and in talking to Sandra, the container recovery lobbyist, they would have to, you know, she would have to bring that form forward. We can't. They requested confidentiality, and we have to protect that. But I can say that you know, I've looked at what they submitted, and they did not submit complete information. We can't draw any conclusions from what that form had. Another question that came up is, why can't, if Container Recovery, Inc. did submit complete information, why can't we use that and have it applied to the entire state, because that would be about half of the information that you would need, Portland area selling about half of the containers that are sold statewide. And you know, we've looked at that, and there's just no way that you can say that what happens in the Portland area can be extrapolated statewide. Portland is sitting on, you know, on the edge of the state line with a major population center next to it, and it's probable that if there are a lot of containers coming across, they'd be coming across from Vancouver into Portland. You can't extrapolate that over to Roseburg or Eugene or Eastern Oregon. And then Representative Thompson talked about tourism on the coast. that throws in a kind of a unique curve into things. So there's no way that, and Ben, the same thing about Ben and tourism. So there's no way that you can take data from the Portland area and say, oh, that's fine, that equals what statewide. So I think the reporting, even if we got good information out of Portland, the reporting statewide would, to get good information, and I think that's what we're after, to get good information, you'd have to have it statewide.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question?
Yes, Representative Thompson.
When you did this survey, I know you're short of manpower, extremely short of manpower. Did you go out and work with the industry at all to get the survey so it was something they could live with? Because I've seen a lot of surveys that were sent out that the industry doesn't buy into because it doesn't relate to the way they function.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, the survey was simple because we're only asking for really two numbers. But we also worked with the lobbyists, Mr. Romaine and Mr. Douglas, beforehand. We worked with them to identify the list of who the survey needs to be sent to. We asked for their cooperation, and I believe they gave it to us in encouraging their members to reply. And you can ask Mr. Romaine, but and I believe we even sent a draft of the survey form to those lobbyists for the beverage distributors. So we were trying to utilize Mr. Romaine and Mr. Douglas so they could encourage their members to comply, because they're the ones who were on the record saying that our members would do this voluntarily. And so I'd find it very difficult to believe that the reason we didn't get a voluntary response was that the form was too complicated. And we do lots of surveys, and we know right away when the form's complicated because the phone rings. Hey, could you help us fill this out? We didn't get that. We got zero response. And in fact, we went back to Mr. Romaine and Mr. Douglas and said, help us out here. We're not getting any response. And I believe Mr. Romaine did try to help us out and did encourage his members to submit the information.
Any questions?
Yes. This is more of a statement. I've been in similar situations many times in my industry, and I'm sure they were sincere in their comments, but when the guy's out in the field working from daylight till dark, and then all of a sudden the form comes down, it just isn't that high on their importance list, so it gets shoved aside. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to say I've been involved in the same situations and can understand both ends of that one.
There's nothing else.
Is the government involved at all now in the Bottleville process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Knopp, yes. For instance, anytime someone has a Bottleville complaint, the Liquor Control Commission is responsible for making sure it works right. So we aren't directly involved with the store-to-store activities, but I'm sure the Control Commission puts in a significant amount of time dealing with the Bottleville, because one thing that comes up, for instance, all the time is a store won't take back crushed cans. And the intent of the bottle bill, well, one thing was to allow it to take back crushed cans so you could, make sure there's less litter out there. And so oftentimes the Liquor Control Commission has to step in and work with the stores to make sure they take crushed cans. So other than the Liquor Control Commission's involvement and our indirect involvement in trying to determine recycling rates, that's the two agencies that are involved.
So we have the crushed bottle police, but beyond that, we don't have any government control on the. It's essentially a private program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinot, I'd say so. Though they, like I said, Liquor Control Commission's in charge of making sure it works right.
Well, I'm concerned that we have a very popular public program, and I'm fairly confident that government could screw it up. I guess my question would be, so we find out the information, then what? I mean, what? I'm not sure. I guess I haven't heard the end game. We're collecting information for what? For what good purpose?
If I may, Mr. Chair, Mr. Knopf. There are two purposes for that. The first purpose is to help people who are interested in preventing easily recyclable materials from ending up in the trash figure out how to go about doing that. And unless they know how much of that is happening, they can't make their programs effective. It's just one of the unfortunate facts of life. You've got to have data before you can have good programs. The second reason is because my association, at least the recyclers, feels that that money could be probably better used to put into local recycling programs rather than to give back to the distributors. I don't think the legislature intended this to be a bill that would make it possible for distributors to have state-of-the-art collection equipment. Perhaps I'm wrong. But if we know how much money is actually out there, then we can decide, okay, you have incurred these levels of expenses, but local recycling programs also have need for some of this money. And if you all think back to the kind of recycling depots, the kind of programs you have in your jurisdiction, I'm sure you can agree that they could probably do with some of that money. They could probably significantly improve their service.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
I haven't heard from one single constituent other than a recycler and distributors on this issue. It seems like the public thinks that their bottle bill is working fine. So, you know, unless I receive this crush of mail that we need to have more studies and surveys regarding each individual bottle and can that is moving in the state and where it's moving and why it's moving there, I guess I would have a hard time understanding why we're going to impose one more study, which will have cost, regardless of how, quote, easy it's going to be. So at this point, I guess I remain unconvinced that this is completely necessary.
Okay. In your statement, you say that the estimate you have 130 to 140 million, deposit containers thrown away each year. So it seems you obviously use some kind of information to get that number. So what makes you think you get better information than that? Or where did you get that number, I guess, would be my first question.
Mr. Chair, I'll answer that. We do, as part of the existing recycling laws of the state, we are directed to do what we call waste composition studies of garbage. And so we actually work with contractors to go out and sort through garbage to determine what's in it. And that's important to do that because this state spends a significant amount of money and resources on trying to keep waste out of the landfill, and it's important to know what's going into the landfill to know what to try to work to keep out. Anyways, and when we do that that landfill study, we determine as part of that how many deposit containers are in the garbage. And so it's from the tail end that we get that information, not from the front end.
Okay.
Mr. Danko, so you go out and just sample a sampling at a landfill on how many cans are in a certain section of garbage, is what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, yes, but not quite like that. It's a very scientifically done sampling around the state. We contract for it. It's professionally done, so it's to make sure that data is representative, and we pick landfills around the state and deal with certain amounts of volumes and proportionate to population and so on. So it's really a little more than just going out and picking a sample, but right.
Do you sample every single landfill across the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, no, we don't. We do representative samplings in various areas of the state, and we do seasonally and so on to get into the tourism-type stuff. And I'd be happy to, if the committee was interested, bring the person who's responsible for overseeing this and to provide additional information on how it's done, because it's really professionally done. In fact, at nationwide conferences and so on, Oregon is often recognized as actually knowing more about its waste stream than many other states, and our sampling methods and so on have been used by other states.
Just one more, Chair. How do you determine when you find that sampling of different bottles and cans what state it came from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gardner, that is, you can't determine what state it came from, and that is part of the problem. We can determine that there are 150 million deposit containers in the garbage, but we can't determine if they were purchased in Washington or purchased in Oregon or purchased somewhere else.
President Morissette.
Thank you. Looking at the big picture of recycling in Oregon, haven't we met and surpassed our goals in terms of the pickup, curbside pickups? And it seems to me that there were some goals that we were to meet, 20% reduction and so on. Where are we in that big picture of recycling in general?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morissette, unfortunately, although participation by people who are able to recycle curbside is very good, and Oregonians are very enthusiastic about recycling, we have met one set of goals, but we seem unlikely to meet the second set. The first set of goals were set for, I believe, 1995, and it was portioned out by depending on the size of each waste shed, which in most cases was a county. And so we have, most counties have been able to meet those goals, but our overall state goal of recycling at 50% or recovery at 50% by the year 2000, we seem very unlikely to meet.
Thank you. Let me get this straight. We've got numbers from Portland area, fairly accurate numbers. We can get those. I understand we're going to get those soon. And you think Portland is a net importer of bottles or cans, potentially? Is that correct,
Mr. Chair? I don't know that. No, that's one reason to do the survey. Mr. Chair, two things. One, we don't have the good information from Portland yet. We may be able to get that in the future. Secondly, I don't think that's representative of the state.
Okay.
And thirdly, the importation. Until we know, it's difficult to say.
Well, let me finish my point. If in fact Portland is probably the biggest importer, if there is an importer in the state, where bottles came from, that your statement said that large metropolitan area in Washington potentially could be, Portland is probably the biggest importer area of the state. Okay. You also admitted to President Thompson's remarks, the coast is probably an importer of bottles. The Bend area, which is another one that you admitted to, that is probably an importer of bottle areas. We then have two major metropolitan areas left in the state that we're concerned about then. Okay, three. Salem, Eugene, Medford. Medford, being a coastal area, would probably also be a net importer. And Salem and Eugene would be the only two left that potentially could be an exporter.
Mr. Chair, you've just impugned our integrity on the coast. We've just included
coastal areas.
Oh, I thought.
Sorry, Representative Thompson.
We have Senator Bishop is going to come up and do some more testifying, but another thing that hasn't been addressed is if we were to do this and we find out there is some money, you know, up to $6.5 million. You know, the voters of the state clearly 4 years ago said that they didn't want to change the bottle bill. How do you expect, or what's your proposal then to get the money from where it is today to where you would like to see it in the recycler's pocket?
That determination would have to be made by the legislature, obviously, and the legislature would be the one who'd decide where that pot of money, assuming that there is, as I do, a pot of money, would go. And we would obviously try to influence you to put some of it into recycling. I think that there are other states that have set up systems where the depositors send the money directly to the state when they make the sale so that it goes through rather than going to and staying with the depositor. It goes to the state and stays there, and then the state makes a determination. I'm not saying, for example, that the collectors of this incur no costs. They do incur costs, and they need to be reimbursed for those costs. I just don't believe that their costs are exactly equal to their receipts. And in fact, I think that they probably are receiving more money than they're putting out. And as you, may I touch on your earlier point? We would very much like to know whether, and the grocery stores, which testified earlier, would very much like to know whether they are over-redeeming containers. And there are probably things that companies could do to make sure that they only got Oregon containers rather than Washington and California and Nevada or wherever. But unless we have this information, we can't really answer that question. We don't know. And they don't know. We all are just kind of guessing. So why not find out? Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
one more point.
I guess I agree, but I have a little different slant on the question of what would you do with the money. I'd rather not even think about that at this point. I'd like to just put to rest the question, is there money out there? And let's take it one step at a time. There's total disagreement on whether there is this pot of money or not, and so let's find out. We can find out and then decide if there is a pot of money. Wow, let's figure out what to do with it. But let's just go one step at a time. Let's find out if there is. One other comment I'd like to make. Thank you for the time. There was comments about distributors that keep. They keep the records as dollars in and dollars out, and they don't count containers. That's no problem. We could easily convert dollars in, dollars out to a number of containers, and this doesn't really add a burden to distributors. They have to keep records for income purposes as dollars in, dollars out on container deposits, and that information itself would be fine. We can convert that. So. The fiscal impact's low, the burden on distributors is low. We could put this question to rest quite easily, and that really it would be good to do that, because if not, we'll be back next time again and trying to put it to rest.
Thank you very much. Andrew Bishop, still here.
We had your tape last time. I understood you had a couple comments, perhaps a report for us.
Yes, I do. Let me quickly finish the tip line that we started before. For the record, my name is Sandra Bishop. I'm representing Container Recovery, Inc., commonly referred to as CRINC. CRINC was incorporated in the Portland area in about 84 and then started operation in the late 80s. It started with four distributors. It now we have a membership of about 14 of the largest distributors in the state. CRINC is actually set up as a cooperative, and never before have we been criticized for having state-of-the-art recycling equipment. All the equipment at CRINC has been developed over 10, 11 years in order for us to accurately account for every container that comes through the facility. So the machines have been improved and actually built on the site. We do have state-of-the-art, which we're proud of, and we count every single container. That's what CRINC is all about, is that accurate record keeping. We have about, in addition to the containers that go through the facility in Portland, we also have about a little over 700 reverse, what we call reverse vending machines around the state, in various parts of the state. And I've said it before, but just for the record and to refresh your memory, CRINC accounts for 55% of the sales in the state as far as the returnable containers. We count, process, and recycle about 800 million containers per year. CRINC is the predominant recycling center for deposit containers. I skipped down here a little bit, but just to reiterate, the statistics already exist, and I will give you copies of those in just a second. There's a very important point that we didn't get to last time that I'd like to go over. And right now, there is no government money in the system, in answer to some of the questions that were raised earlier. The industry pays the cost. It costs approximately $7 million a year to collect and process and account for and then recycle the materials from the redeemed containers. And as far as I want to look at one issue, which is administrative cost of such a program. And someone testifying in the last hearing throughout, in other states, they do this kind of counting. I think you need to be very, very careful and get the facts on those other states. California spends something like $25 million a year in administrative costs. It's very, very difficult to administer any of these kind of programs. They have not been successful in other states to do this kind of counting. And for the $10,000, which was the fiscal from DEQ, what are you actually buying? What are you doing? Is that the best use? It seems like a small change when talking about billion-dollar budgets, but it's $10,000. What are you actually getting? What I want to talk about is the reliability of the count. The numbers that I will give out today are audited through Price, Waterhouse, and Cooper. It used to be Coopers and Lybrand. And we count every container, as I said. So you've got reliability on 55%, equal to 55% of the sales of containers in the state. It is beyond common sense for DEQ to say that a waste composition study is done and has a representative sampling is done for their waste composition studies, and these are the best in the nation, but you can't do any sort of extrapolation out from 55% on an accurate count of returnable containers. It just doesn't make sense. I can't quite understand the common sense of that. As far as reliability of the count, the purpose of an annual survey of returnable containers would seem to be to get an accurate count of what containers are redeemed, reused, and recycled. The only way to do that is to count the containers. The bill does not do that. That is precisely what CRINC does. The most accurate numbers possible already exist. And I want to just spend a couple minutes here to really look at the actuality of what's being asked for in the bill.
Are you going to give us your count?
Yes. As soon as I give you the rationale why it can't be done other ways. Weight is not a reliable measure.
Before we go down, mm-hmm. why don't you just go ahead and give us your
sure.
count. And
sure.
if there's any questions of the committee, I think we can wrap up in that manner rather than spend a whole lot more time here.
Oh, I need one of those. I think it's very important for you to understand that weight is not a reliable measure for counting containers, and I'll go through this really fast.
We're going to go to some questions right now, if there are any questions.
Numbers first.
Well, we're getting the numbers, I have a short question.
Okay.
As soon as she gets back to this.
There.
Your 800 million containers, what percentage of those roughly are cans?
I don't know what the breakdown is between the three types of containers. There's aluminum, plastic, and glass, and I don't have that figure on the top of my head.
And you say that it costs you $7 million. And the reason I was asking, the cans are worth, I know, X cents per can. And I just wondered if you knew the percentage, but I can't pursue that if you don't know the percentage.
Sir, I don't have the answer to that question, though I can say that, for the most part, aluminum is the only commodity that does tend to retain some value other than the redemption value.
That's why I was trying to see that.
Right.
And this, your count is dollars in, dollars out. I assume you have all, there's also by cans, bottles. Is that correct?
Chair Byer. No, the figures that you see in front of you are the only figures that we have as far as the totals.
So when you say you count every can, you don't count every can. You just go by dollars in, dollars out.
No, you have to, excuse me, Chair Byer, members of the committee, we do count every container, and then we figure the deposit for each container, and that's how you come up with the dollar figure.
So would it be asking too much for you to ask you to provide the information in numbers of containers by type of containers?
Chair, Byer, members of the committee, what would be the purpose of asking of the breakdown?
That would answer the question then. This really doesn't answer the question. The question is, what the numbers of containers, this is simply a percentage in the dollars in, dollars out.
Chair Byer.
No.
Is it safe to say that if you take a nickel, since all the everything's redeemed at a nickel, and you times that by the number of cans or whatever, you come up with your dollar amount? So we can go back the other way and say...
Okay, was it?
Chair Byer, members of the committee, yes, that is correct. It's based on the nickel. It'll be a little off here and there.
So is every deposited bottle or can a nickel now?
It's 2 cent beer bottle. All five.
Those went, by the way.
Oh, okay.
When the ethyl went out.
Probably 2 decades ago. Yes, sir. It should be the 5 cent deposit. Let me take a moment.
Senator, we need to move on. So.
Is there another, isn't there a larger bottle that's worth more than 5 cents, or is everything worth five, even the large ones?
Chair, by Representative Thompson, I believe everything covered under the Oregon Bottle Bill is 5 cents, because it's carbonation and malt that triggers it, so I believe it's 5 cents. There are a lot of companies who choose, I know I buy a lot of bottles that are 20 and 25 cent deposits, but that's not covered under the bottle bill, and it doesn't, and they're not products that are handled through a distributor. I just wanted to explain what the columns are so you'd understand. The first column, total deposits received, is what's collected from wholesalers in money. The total deposits paid is what's refunded to retailers in money. And then the percentage is the percentage of containers redeemed. And I would just draw your attention to the second page of the testimony. Weight is not a reliable measure for counting containers. This bill will not work. Doesn't matter what the intention is behind it or what you're trying to get. You will not get accurate figures if you use weight. In 11 years, CRINC has never found any correlation between weight and the number of containers when you're dealing in larger volumes. So if you don't count every container, you're not going to do it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions, committee? Thank you very much. Don't think we're going to move this bill forward. I encourage the recycle or the distributors that if DEQ does their voluntary survey again to get numbers from downstate, the other potential areas that are not reporting at this time, and try to solve this way. I don't think the proper approach would bring government and involve it into a working program. So. Close the public hearing. Okay. Start from the back. Yes. Go to 3580.
We have a hearing.
That's right.
Yes.
We're scheduled for a work hearing and work session just for Saturday.
Work session.
Well, I'm in a work session on House Bill 3580. Anyone sign up to testify or to talk about this bill? Ms. Putnam, would you like to bring us up to speed on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, there's. I tried to hand deliver the -1 amendments to everybody yesterday. I'll redistribute those now. This is a gut and stuff. It's still a process by which the civil penalties can be raised from whatever they had been to $10,000. This bill differs from the original in that it deals only with violations of the plumbing and electrical codes.
Thank you. Members, we have in front of us the -1 amendments. I believe everyone has those in their packets. Is that correct? We have Joe Brewer wanting to speak to this issue. We'll bring him up on it so he can answer any questions if there are any. Would you like to come up also? Okay. Would you state your name for the record, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator of the Building Codes Division. My purpose in being here this morning is simply to share some numbers with respect to the total number of cases and their nature. In 1998, There were a total of 457 plumbing violations of three different code areas, 984 electrical violations of different code areas, broken down between the plumbing, electrical, and the one and two family dwelling code. A number of those, and I didn't pick this, no, well, with respect to plumbing, 93 of those cases were permit cases. 232 of the electrical cases were permit cases. And I apologize for not having this ready to hand out, but we received the heads up on this very late. The department's official position on this bill is neutral, but I would like to point out that in a cursory 10-minute review of our records, I found at least six companies that appear to have folded the cost of violations into their cost of doing business, with as many as 22 repeat violations of different licensing and permit areas. So I just felt the committee should have that information this morning, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions, Mr. Brewer? Go ahead.
Good morning, Chairman Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Brian Krieg, and I'm representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, who requested this bill. PMCA represents over 250 contractors involved in plumbing and mechanical construction and maintenance. Most of our members are small businesses with an average of 5 employees. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 3580 with the Dash 1 amendments, which replaced the bill. This bill solves problem with civil penalty limits on plumbing and electrical license violations. In the audience, if technical questions do come up, I do have Keith Edwards, who is the Assistant Business Manager of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Keith serves on the State Electrical and Elevator Board. Also is Gary Wright, Business Agent for UA 290 Plumbers and Steam Fitters, and he is a former member of the State Plumbing Board. State law currently requires plumbers and electricians to be licensed, and only they may do certain types of plumbing and electrical work. These laws were put into place to protect the public and property. Currently, we have a problem in the industry, though, of some contractors who are not licensed that habitually violate state laws by employing unlicensed workers to do electrical and plumbing work. And this bill only addresses electrical and plumbing with the Dash 1.
Ryan, we're in a work session. We're not in, taking public testimony right now. So if we have any questions, we will, please just stay there because we answer any questions about the bill. Amendments. Captain Morissette?
President
Gardner.
This is permissive, basically. It allows it to go up to $10,000. It does not make it mandatory in any way, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, that's my understanding.
That is correct.
Members, if you look at the original bill, the maximum civil penalty for construction contractors is $5,000 under current law. I feel that, personally, that maybe we should be consistent, and I would be comfortable with taking this approach to go from 1 to 5 rather than 1 to 10. That's a 500% increase. That seems like fairly substantial. And we've also done other bills this session dealing with plumbers and electricians, bringing them, giving the VCBS more authority in certain codes of law. So we can maybe solve some of the problems that way. So I would be comfortable at this time if we would suspend the rules for the conceptual amendment into the bill to go from to change the 10,000 to 5,000 and pass the bill in that manner.
Well, Mr. Chair, while I would probably prefer that we go from 1,000 to 100,000, I certainly support the conceptual amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the conceptual amendment to move from 1,000 to 5,000.
I would ask for suspension of rules.
I will.
For the purpose of conceptually amending the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3580, are the objections to that motion? Seeing none, the order is okay. Representative Canopa moves to conceptually amend in line 9 of the Dash 1 amendments the $10,000 figure and make it $5,000. A discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chairman, would you also want to make that amendment on lines 20, wherever 10,000 appears?
Yes, on lines 23 and on line 17 on page 2. Yes, there's three places. It appears. So it has been moved that we conceptually amend the amendments to replace the 10,000 wherever it appears in the amendment, and there would be three places. Objections to the amendment? None ordered. Representative Canope?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash one amendment as conceptually amended. I'll move the dash one amendment into 3580.
Okay, Representative Knope moves the dash one amendments with a conceptual amendment into House Bill 3580. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none. Objection? Seeing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Putman.
We have a fiscal impact statement on the original bill, which was listed as minimal. Because there are less agencies involved now, I believe it would at least stay minimal, if not.
Go to less than minimal?
Less than minimal. Less than minimal. Whatever that may be. Okay.
That's down to almost nothing.
Representative Canope.
Chair, I'll move House Bill 3580 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
House Bill 3580 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Canope?
Aye.
Representative Lindquist?
Aye.
Representative Minshew?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 3580 moves the floor as a due pass recommendation. Volunteers to carry the bill? Senator Gardner?
Be happy.
Please carry the bill. Thank you very much. Special vote. Okay. As Mr. Putman catches up on his paperwork, we will. We will now go into a work session on House Bill 2608. Open the work session. 2608. Mr. Putnam, you have a little short update for us?
Let's see. I believe the committee finished its business except for motions and voting. You had heard testimony about a revision that was put in here at the request of, just a moment. Give me a moment, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Yeah. I was starting to explain the wrong bill to you. I apologize for that. What I said first is still there. This has to do with changing the law on personal injury protection so that the vehicle that has to pay out must specifically be named in the policy rather than allowing stacking, where if you have five policies, you could actually, the insurer would have to pay five times the statutory amount.
Okay, we have before us the committee members a dash one amendment to House Bill 2608, which is a gut and stuff. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2608.
Representative Gardner moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2608. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none. The objections? Seeing none. So ordered. Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2608 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner moves House Bill 2608 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Call the roll.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Knopf?
Aye.
Representative Lundquist?
Yes.
Representative Marquette?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Yes.
Representative Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair Beyer?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2608 as amended moves before the due pass recommendation. Volunteers to carry that bill. Representative Atkinson, you want to carry the bill?
We're back to A's again.
So ordered, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2608, and Representative Bowman, that is her bill. If she no longer likes the content, she, of course, do we have to notify her that she can have her name taken off and it will become a committee bill?
She has to send a letter in notifying us that it wants to become a committee bill if she wishes to name off.
Okay.
And I'll discuss that.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Morissette.
Just for the record, you did speak with Representative Bowman, she's fine with this situation.
Okay, what have we got left? 2021? Okay. We will open a, are we saying for public hearing and work session?
Work session.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2021. Mr. Putman, would you like to raise up to date on?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is a total gut and stuff. Do I have, have I given you folks copies of the dash one? I think
I have dash one amendments in my packet.
Oh, very good.
Have dash one amendments? Okay.
It is a gut and stuff. Basically, this is intended to correct a problem that has recently arisen. It's been the practice of the workers' comp agency to continue to pay doctors for care given after. It's usually an insurance company's claims processor's rule that a patient has reached a medically stationary state. Until the doctor who's actually been treating the patient knows that, he will or she will, in good faith, continue to provide the care. That practice was based on a rule, and the Attorney General has recently concluded that the agency lacked the statutory authority to make that rule. So what this does is puts into the statute the basis for what has been many years of practice, so the guy can get paid until he gets written notice.
Okay. We have Nancy Becker,
Bieber,
and Jim Anderson.
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
State your names for the record.
Okay, for the record, my name is Nancy Bieber, and I'm the acting manager of the dispute resolution section of the Workers' Compensation Division. And this is Jim Anderson of the Oregon Medical Association. We're here to testify today in support of the Dash 1 amendments to 2021, which Mr. Putnam explained pretty well. I've provided some written testimony, but I just wanted to give you a little background on how this amendment came about. As Mr. Putnam indicated, we had a rule that allowed or required insurers to pay doctors for services they provided to medically stationary workers if the doctor was unaware of the worker's medically stationary status. In most cases, the treating doctor is the one who makes the medically stationary determination, but occasionally an insurance company, either through an independent medical evaluation or their review of the medical evidence, will make that determination themselves, and sometimes the determination will even be made retroactively, especially through an independent medical evaluation. The statute currently provides that only limited services can be provided to a medically stationary worker and doesn't create an exception for this period of time between services might be rendered and the doctor knows about the worker's status. Our rule, as Mr. Putnam indicated, was found to be invalid by the Department of Justice, and also at their recommendation, we changed the rule to create a penalty instead of a direct obligation to pay, but we are concerned that the new rule also may not survive a challenge. So we brought this matter to the Medical Advisory Committee, and they endorsed the idea of fixing the problem by statute to make sure doctors could be reimbursed for services they provided in good faith. And the Oregon Medical Association also endorsed the concept. We then brought it to the Management Labor Advisory Committee, And SAFE expressed some concern, not so much with the concept, but with the actual language that we had proposed. As a result, Jim and Chris Davies of SAFE got together and worked out the language that's in the -1 amendments now. We presented that language to the Management Labor Legislative Subcommittee last week, and they also endorsed the bill as it's written now. So I'm going to turn it over to Jim to explain the Oregon Medical Association's take on this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Anderson with the Oregon Medical Association. As Ms. Bieber said, the OMA is in complete support of this issue, and we've worked long and hard since Mary Neidig and Nancy got hold of us, telling us of the Attorney General's and the court's opinion of the rule. The amendments you see before you, we have worked on. As Nancy said, the MLAC has seen this, has passed on it. SAFE Corporation and the OMA have worked out the amendments along with the Workers' Comp Division. And all we can do at this point, I think, is urge the committee to consider this and pass the bill onto the floor.
Thank you. Questions of witnesses? Thank you very much. Does anyone else like to testify in this bill? See no one. We'll close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 2021.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments to House Bill 2021.
Representative Gardner moves the -1 amendments into House Bill 2021. Discussion on the motion? Objections? See none, so ordered. Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2021 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Gardner moves House Bill 2021 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, first call the roll. Is our President Marcet and President Thompson outside?
We've done that before. We're not here, I guess.
Okay. Go ahead, Stan.
Representative Cano?
Aye.
Representative Lundquist?
Aye.
Representative Marcet?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Excused.
Representative Atkinson?
Aye.
Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Chair Byer?
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2021 was the floor of the due pass recommendation. Who's sure as a count?
Oh, I'll do that.
President Marcet will carry. Work session closed.
We got one left.
I think that completes our agenda for today. We are adjourned.